This New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A new WMUR Granite State poll released just last night indicates that, 4 months out from November's elections, Governor Maggie Hassan sits on a generous lead, as does the 2nd District Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer. Not so, according to the poll, for 1st District Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. The Granite poll will issue its U.S. Senate race results today. This survey is the latest in a primary election season that kicked off in mid-June and has been pretty active already, with debates, TV and radio ads, continuing drama over who should bow out now, and big-name national politicians like Chris Christie and Martin O'Malley coming in to support New Hampshire candidates. This hour on The Exchange, a summer check-in on the fall elections, what you need to know before voting in the primary in September and the general election in November. Let's hear from you. What candidates do you want to know more about? What observations do you have about the campaigning that's happened so far? We're looking at the races for U.S. House and Senate, also governor this hour, so give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests in studio are Josh Rogers, NHPR's Statehouse reporter. And Josh, thanks for making time out for us.
No problem, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Dante Scala, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNH and a fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute. And Dante, good to see you, too. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you and Dante, you first. Let's talk about some of these primaries first. 2 months from today, September 9th, voters in the parties will pick their nominees and all the actions on the Republican side. The 4 Democratic office holders don't face any internal party opposition. So, Dante, the narrative for Republicans nationally in these primaries has been Tea Party versus establishment. What about in New Hampshire? Do we see that same dynamic?
To a smaller extent, New Hampshire is a state where the Tea Party has never had a major breakthrough. There's never been a candidate with clearly the Tea Party's supported candidate who's won a major primary. And by that, I mean either for the congressional districts, for Senate, or for governor. This time around, again, the Tea Party's on the outside looking in. Arguably, one could say Bob Smith, a former New Hampshire senator, is the most likely Tea Party candidate. In fact, he has the support of Jack Kimball, a Tea Partier who is a former Republican chair. But right now, at least, Smith's chances of winning the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to run against Jean Shaheen, the odds seem long. Now, as we know, primaries are notoriously volatile. 4 years ago in 2010, no one was talking much about Ovid LaMontagne's chances of winning the U.S. Senate Republican nomination, and he came awfully close to doing so. So a lot remains to be seen, but right now, it's clear that a Tea Party victory in New Hampshire for any of the major races would be something of an upset.
How do you hear that label, Kevin Landrigan, being used, Tea Party, this time around? Is it as big as it was in 2010, for example, the last midterms that we had?
Yeah, I would say not, but certainly folks who have views that the Tea Party have are number many Republican primary voters in New Hampshire, and they're a constituency that Republicans running in any primary want to court. And so virtually every major candidate is appealing to voters who might also be fiscally conservative like the Tea Parties are, support liberty and freedom as Tea Parties do. So it's really about, and even in 2010 in New Hampshire, it's really always been trying to strike that balance for any candidate who wants to win the nomination, to appeal to the Tea Party base or the very libertarian base that exists here in the Republican Party, while still gaining support from the establishment, which, after all, is very important in Republican Party politics in New Hampshire. It always has been. Frank Ginter was a good example of that, who really, in 2010, won the seat in Congress, essentially declared himself a Tea Party candidate at that point, but was able, because he was former mayor of Manchester and active in the Republican Party politics to attract establishment support and establishment money in order to coast to that nomination and beat Carol Shea Porter.
While we're looking at national trends and how they might be playing out in New Hampshire, Josh, this one's for you. Since their loss in 2012 nationally, Republicans have been looking at their party's demographics, saying the party needs to expand to more minorities, more young people, more women. How's that effort reflected here in New Hampshire during this Republican primary season?
Well, two of the congressional candidates on the GOP side, Dan Innes in District 1, he's fiscally conservative, openly gay, Republican, former dean at the business school at UNH. He's running and, seems to be picking up some momentum as an alternative to Ginta. As Kevin pointed out, Frank Ginta did a really good job of sort of straddling what can be a divide between establishment Republicans and, real sort of conservatives who make up a lot of primary voters. There are some in the party who feel Ginta is a bit shop-worn at this point, and Dan Innes is making a play for them and saying, we need a new sort of Republican in District 2, Marilinda Garcia. She's served time at the State House a number of terms. She's young. She's of Mexican descent, and she has been playing that up, and she's staunchly conservative and has gotten a lot of national attention. National attention to the extent that some who've witnessed her at the State House might say outstrips her accomplishments in the New Hampshire legislature. The most notable bill that I can recall her ever being involved in was one that sought to give tax breaks to the Cancer Treatment Centers of America. But beyond that, really didn't make any great headlines out of the State House. But she's certainly received a lot of attention. The fundraising hasn't necessarily materialized for her yet, but she's certainly running a strong race in that primary against a former state senator in Gary Lambert. And that one is really hard to pick at this point. There are a number of factors in that race that sort of transcend the identity politics of it and get to specific issues, involving, sort of Nashua, where Lambert is from. There are a lot of voters there. Salem, where she's from, crucial in a Republican primary, her lack of support for a casino, how that might play out. But certainly Innes and Garcia are two people who, are presenting themselves as freshened GOP faces.
Yeah. What do you think about this, Dante? We did a whole show on this with some state Republicans when they did that whole autopsy on sort of what happened in 2012. And definitely broadening the base was a big theme.
Yeah. On top of that, there's in the second CD Republican race, there's Jim Lawrence, an African-American state representative from Hudson, who just entered the race in the last few weeks. Marilinda Garcia is a good case of how blurry the lines have become when it comes to talking about the Tea Party. The national political media has taken turns either talking about the death of the Tea Party or the rebirth of the Tea Party when Eric Cantor lost down in Virginia a few weeks ago. The answer is probably more complicated than that because to some extent, the Tea Party has become the Republican Party in the sense that, to win nominations, you have to run a very conservative line around the country to become the nominee. So to what extent, even though we don't have necessarily as many Tea Party victories, one could argue the Tea Party has moved the whole party to the right. And so Garcia, is she a Tea Party candidate? I wouldn't describe her that at first glance, but is she a very conservative candidate who could become the nominee? The answer is yes.
The phone number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Join us as we look at some of the primaries coming up. 2 months from today is primary election day here in the Granite State. And then, of course, we're looking ahead to the fall elections. We're talking about some of the candidates for the big races in New Hampshire this year. That means governor, first congressional district, second congressional district, and U.S. Senate. Give us a call with your thoughts, questions, comments at 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. So as we look at some of these big races, gentlemen, let's tackle the U.S. Senate first, because that's one that is getting a lot of attention. And I think to you first, Josh Rogers, how are the national handicappers, those big national pundits like Cook Political Report and so forth, how are they weighing this U.S. Senate race? How much interest is it grabbing nationally?
Well, it was grabbing a great deal of interest early on during the protracted courtship of Scott Brown by Republicans at the national level and at the state level to get him into this race. But it seems to be sliding a bit in terms of the view of national handicappers, who aren't always right, of course, about how these things turn out. It's, you know, maybe in the top 10 potential pickups for Republicans, but it's seen by none of these handicappers as being in the top five. And part of that reason is that Scott Brown hasn't seemingly eaten into what has been, you know, basically a low double-digit poll advantage that Jeanne Shaheen has. And part of that may be due to voters who are very familiar with her, and part of that may be due to, you know, Scott Brown failing to do much more than running against the president and Obamacare thus far. And, you know, while that may prove effective ultimately, you know, it hasn't been, you know, lightning in a bottle for him thus far.
And Kevin, how much has Scott Brown been running as a primary candidate against, again, as we've mentioned, former U.S. Senator Bob Smith and former State Senator Jim Rubins? How much is he running against those guys, and how much is he just focusing on Jeanne Shaheen?
Yeah, it's a delicate balance for Scott Brown, and I think it has something to do with what Josh was talking about, that Scott Brown, I mean, I wrote a story yesterday about the fact that and it was a typical week, frankly, for the last couple of months, where in paid media he's essentially being attacked from the left and from the right. From the left, the League of Conservation Voters, because he's tied to billionaires who support tax breaks for oil companies. From the right, the new website created by this super PAC that supports Jim Rubins, that he's not a true conservative, that he supported Obama when he was president over 70% of the time, when he was a state senator in Massachusetts, supported tax and fee increases of great significance. This is the problem. It's really the perfect storm for Scott Brown. His name recognition is extremely high here in New Hampshire, but the ideological polls are both trying to define him before he's able to fully define himself as to who he is.
Well, and that's led to some sniping in the Republican primary about who should drop out, who shouldn't, and we'll find out more about that in just a moment. You can join us, too, with your thoughts, questions, comments on this year's elections, the primaries in September, the general election in November. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts will be taking your questions as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. The Exchange on the Road is happening at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem tomorrow evening. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Partly sunny today, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, highs in the 80s. Partly cloudy, chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, lows tonight from 50 north, ranging 60s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from People's United Bank, helping businesses, small and large, grow to the next level in branches and online at peoples.com. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth, intimately yours, presentation of the male a cappella group Straight No Chaser, Tuesday, July 15th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what you need to know before the September primary and November general election here in New Hampshire. We're looking at some of the big races for governor, U.S. Congress, and the U.S. Senate. One of the dynamics that's been developing in the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate is two of the candidates urging the other to get out. We're going to hear a little bit of sound from that now. Here's Bob Smith, the former U.S. senator, in a primary debate on June 22nd over, again, who should bow out, who shouldn't, so that Republicans can be unified going into the general election.
My sources are 100% impeccable that you colluded with the Republican Party of the state of New Hampshire in either the preparation of that letter or that you asked that that letter be sent on to put me on the spot in regards to my reason, which I will go to later, as to why I didn't sign it.
Again, that's former U.S. Senator Bob Smith, who's running in the U.S. Senate primary to go back to the Senate, talking about a unity letter. And Kevin Landrigan, Bob Smith has been upset about, you know, people suggesting he get out, and then he's suggesting Jim Rubins get out, and feeling testy about the idea that there's a unity letter. What's going on in that primary in terms of that dynamic?
Well, what it really comes down to is that when the dust settles by August 1st, either Jim Rubins or Bob Smith has to be the alternative to Scott Brown.
August 1st.
Yeah, or they has to be seen as the alternative to Scott Brown, or they're not going to be able to beat Scott Brown in this primary. So the two of them are not only natural allies and opponents, but they come, both Jim Rubins and Bob Smith, frankly, come from different wings of the party. Jim Rubins, when he was a state senator, was very much a social moderate, pro-choice, pro-climate change. Bob Smith, a doctrinaire conservative throughout his career. So this notion that, which really bothers Bob Smith, that he's not the the only constitutional conservative, as he calls himself, in this race, is extremely irritating to him and, frankly, is the biggest obstacle to him breaking through and becoming the alternative to Brown.
Yeah, there's been a lot on Twitter, Dante, from what I understand, back and forth yesterday between Rubens and Smith saying, you get out. No, you get out.
Yeah. The thing is, there is an opening in this primary for a viable, authentic, conservative alternative to Scott Brown. I mean, again, compared to 4 years ago, Kelly Ayotte, who had the support of pro-life groups, who had the support of Sarah Palin, and the support of the Republican establishment, almost lost to a severely underfunded conservative challenger, Ovid Lamontagne. Scott Brown is to the left of Kelly Ayotte on guns. He is to the left of Kelly Ayotte on abortion. And yet, he doesn't right now appear to have the worries that Kelly Ayotte had 4 years ago. And that's in large part because neither one of these conservative alternatives has convinced voters or activists or elites just yet that they have a viable campaign, that they can beat Jean Shaheen, or that they can even beat Scott Brown.
Well, I mean, one thing, I mean, you look back to that 2010 primary, and that was interesting. You know, I spent a lot of time following Ovid Lamontagne around, and he really did a good job of making core conservative voters feel good about supporting him. And there was a dynamic where there was sniping between Kelly Ayotte and Bill Binney, and a lot of people gravitated towards Lamontagne at the end, and he came quite close to winning. You know, in this case, so far, you know, the two candidates doing the sniping are Bob Smith and Jim Rubins, and that you know, will make it hard for a lot of people to feel like, oh, I feel really great about voting for these guys. You know, both of whom have, you know, haven't been elected for some time, and both of whom have the capacity of rubbing segments of the GOP electorate the wrong way.
Yeah, well, we've talked about Bob Smith and Scott Brown. Let's talk a little bit more about Jim Rubins, former state senator for a long time, former chair of the Senate Education Committee, known for his work against casino gambling here in the Granite State. Here's how Rubins describes his political background in an interview in late May.
If you talk with the so-called establishment types, what do they say about me? Completely credible, know what I'm talking about, have solutions to issues, not crazy.
So Josh Rogers, there's Jim Rubins kind of just putting himself out there as a conservative, but also, as he says, not crazy.
Well, I mean, I think he was speaking in the context of, you know, if Scott Brown doesn't pan out, there will be money there. There will be people that will, he can unite the party and mount a credible challenge to Jean Shaheen. And so that's the point he was making there. I mean, Jim Rubins is a complicated political figure. You know, he entered this race with a carbon tax as one of his big issues. He stepped away from that and said, came right out and said, you know, it's a non-starter politically. And, you know, the super PAC that's backing him is challenging, you know, Scott Brown to, you know, do the same on issues where he's changed. You know, remains to be seen if that'll happen. But, you know, Jim Rubins comes to the race having long held views that aren't popular with segments of the Republican base. He sought to move away from that. He's energetic. There's no doubt he tries hard. He's smart. You know, a perfect candidate. You know, no one is, and nor is he. But
sure.
he's been trying to say he's the viable alternative to Brown. You know, Smith is saying I'm the true conservative. you know, it's interesting to watch. But, you know, yesterday's performance on Twitter with them, you know, once you get in this position of being demanding someone else get out of the race, you know, that's not a suggestion of good health.
Yeah. And Dante, you know, Josh mentions the carbon tax and Jim Rubens has been pro-choice for a long time. That could be difficult in a Republican primary. Again, primaries are different.
Right. I mean, if you're going to vote for a pro-choice Republican, which it appears at least a lot of establishment Republicans, somewhat conservative Republicans are prepared to do, then why not vote for a candidate like Scott Brown, who appears, at least on paper, a more viable candidate versus Gene Shaheen than Jim Rubens? I mean, Jim Rubens, at this point, he's been campaigning a long time. According to my colleague Andy Smith's polling at UNH, he's known by perhaps one out of five Republicans, know enough about him to express even a very simple opinion about him. Compared that to Bob Smith. Actually, Bob Smith is not known by half of Republicans, but about 40%. That's better, a lot better than where Rubens is right now.
Especially where we are at this point in the campaign. I mean, it's only early July, right?
But at least Rubens has self-funded his campaign to the tune of $500,000. So at least he has some money to spend. It's not at all clear Bob Smith is going to be able to do anything other than grassroots politicking.
Kevin, you want to jump in real quick?
No, I just wanted to say that I mean, Josh is right that Jim Rubens hasn't been on the ballot statewide since 1998 and even in a state Senate election since 2000. But people definitely underestimated him in that campaign for governor. He almost won the Republican nomination against an establishment figure, Jay Lucas, who was self-funded, had millions of dollars and spent it on his campaign. He's a relentless campaigner with people. I think that's one of the things that frustrates Smith the most about Jim Rubens is he won't go away. He's attracted all kinds of support from grassroots activists that kind of caused Smith to begin to try and tear his hair out. I mean, the Republican Liberty Caucus endorsed Jim Rubens. That's a group that is right in Bob Smith's wheelhouse, extremely fiscally conservative. What are they doing endorsing a pro-choice Republican? But Rubens went after the leadership in that group hard over and over again, I mean, and won their endorsement.
They said that they spent more than, I think it was 15 hours talking.
Wow, that's a lot.
Prior to that endorsement. And so, I mean, you know, you're not going to outwork Jim Rubens. Whether or not that's going to pay off, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to all of you about the value of endorsements since you mentioned the Republican Liberty Caucus. Let me also remind our listeners, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So speaking of endorsements, former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney was in New Hampshire a couple weeks back supporting former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. Let's hear what the former Governor Romney said about Scott Brown.
I know that the president is not on the ballot this November, but the people of New Hampshire have a chance to vote on what they think about the president's agenda. And they'll do that by saying what they will about the president's number one supporter, Gene Shaheen.
So again, that's Mitt Romney endorsing Scott Brown. Although, Dante, in that clip we just heard, he actually doesn't say the word Scott Brown. He goes after President Obama.
Right, which seems to be the strategy of Scott Brown's campaign as well. Endorsements matter not much at all in general elections, somewhat in primaries. I mean, if Mitt Romney had come in and endorsed Jim Rubens, that would have made big waves and so forth. I think when Mitt Romney comes in and endorses Scott Brown, people shrug and say, sure.
But, it's expected.
Yeah, but it collects one thing that Scott Brown can do that neither Rubens nor Smith can do at this point is generate a lot of free media. And things like this, the Romney endorsement at the Scammon Farm, which is the site of so many historic events in the Republican Party, you know, that just sucks all the oxygen out of the room for Rubens and Smith, who really need to make every day of the next 2 months count in terms of getting their message across to likely Republican primary voters.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I just wanted to say, too, and when does he time that announcement? The week before the July 4th holiday weekend, which, after all, is probably the most important week until the week before Labor Day primary. I mean, once July 4th ends, we're in the dog days of summer, and even if you're getting free media, nobody's reading it. They're on vacation or they're distracted. So Romney and Brown clearly timed this not only to get the maximum free media, but also at the perfect time. It was important for Romney to endorse Brown early. Why? Because a late endorsement from Romney to Brown would could actually backfire, because all the focus would be on Brown's support for Romneycare, which is very similar to Obamacare at the national level. Getting it done at this point, early before the summer season begins, sort of gets that narrative out of the way. He deals with whatever fallout, and he has plenty of time to deal with that fallout now.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, or what Republicans call Obamacare, because that's going to be an issue in these fall races, and I want to ask all of you about that. But another issue that's cropped up recently is gas prices. And here's an email to that effect from Ray in Whitefield. He says, I was reading in today's Coos County Democrat about Scott Brown's visit to Coos County. One of his quotes, everyone's paying more at the pump, oil and gas rates are going up. Ray says, of course, the reference was that it was President Obama's fault. Mr. Brown should know that the president, any president, does not control oil prices. Can one imagine the conservative reaction if the president attempted to affect energy prices? Ray in Whitefield, thanks for that email. And Josh Rogers, gas prices have become an issue in some of these campaigns.
Well, I mean, certainly the New Hampshire's gas tax has gone up for the first time, you know, in a long time, 4.2 cents. That's been something Republicans have gone after Governor Hassan on, and it's become an issue in Republican primaries. And, you know, the support at the federal level for potential increase of gas taxes is also something. I mean, I see this, you know, it's also the gas prices go up in the summer. People are driving in the summer. It's something that we hear about most campaign seasons to some extent. I do think for Scott Brown's campaign, it's one sign that, you know, that the we can just make this simply about Obamacare, you know, may not be panning out. You know, outside advocacy groups have been, you know, hitting all the people who supported the local gas tax increase. So, you know, we'll see. You know, gas prices go up every summer. But, you know, this is, you know, this Obama taxes, Obamacare, and an anti-incumbent feeling is what Republicans hope is going to mean good things for them in the fall. And, you know, on the flip side of that, Democrats are focusing on, you know, cultural issues, the Hobby Lobby ruling, the buffer zone ruling. You know, they're trying to mobilize women, who have been, you know, crucial to Democratic victories here in New Hampshire. So I think, you know, we're going to see those larger dynamics, you know, play out for the rest of this election.
Well, you mentioned Obamacare, and certainly a couple months ago, Josh, a lot of people thought that was going to be the issue this time around in these U.S. Senate and congressional races. Sounds like you're still seeing it discussed. Is it as key and big an issue as you expected, or as many people expected a couple months ago? Has it died down?
It's hard to know. I mean, certainly, you know, the fact that more carriers are joining the local exchange, you know, it has allowed, you know, this to be blunted a bit. You know, people are getting accustomed to it. We'll see. I mean, there may be, you know, renewals could go out. I mean, the timing of that before the election could reignite this. I mean, this is still something that Democrats are worried about. But, you know, a lot of them are also confident that, you know, once people get more accustomed to this, this won't be as toxic as it had been perceived to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dante, your thoughts on that as well, what Josh says about we really don't know how Obamacare is going to play out in the general elections.
Right. I mean, I think it'll be an issue that animates Republicans, but it's also an issue that animates, you know, Democrats to some degree, although not as much. I think it angers Republicans more than it makes Democrats enthusiastic. But I think, Josh, it's right. It's settling down to be one of the issues. It's awfully hard to make any election about one issue. I mean, the day after an election, we always look back and say, oh, right, the election was about X. But honestly, in the elections are a lot of noise and a lot of issues and a lot of messages. If it's not about the economy, it's tough to drive one message every day, week after week. And we're seeing that with Scott Brown. Early on, it was Obamacare. Now it's energy. And they're struggling to find something with some leverage against Shaheen. Now, the question is, if the economy continues to get better, as the last several months have shown, if the economy takes off in the summer and the fall, then a good economy or a improving economy might not quite snuff out, but weaken some of these smaller issues that are more topical, like energy or Obamacare, that are more narrow than, say, a growing economy.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Thanks for that email, Ray. You can email us as well at exchange@nhpr.org. Jonathan's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Kelly. Good morning. Sorry, I was thinking Ms. Ayotte for a second. My question was about the authenticity of the GOP, the issue in New Hampshire right now, when you have, you know, it seems like Scott Brown is the inevitable. I mean, I know we're talking about the other race, the Smith and running, but between that and also the head of the RNC now, a former campaign worker for Chris Christie. And so it seems like they're importing people, and whatever happened to the old guard, you know, New Hampshire GOP, you know, I know that was the party for my whole time growing up and for my parents and grandparents' generation.
So who's made a real granite and who isn't, Jonathan? Is that what you're saying?
I just want to know why there aren't, for a state that has so many Republicans, why isn't there stronger representation to go up against Brown?
More homegrown.
And my other comment would be that I probably assume, you know, given that Gene Shaheen is pretty loved by even people on the other side, even if they complain about her, it seems to me that Scott Brown will probably wait and that maybe he'll go to fill Ms. Ayotte's seat if she gets the vice presidential nomination, like so many people are saying that she may for the Republican Party.
Well, for now, Jonathan, we're going to thank you. For now, we're going to stick with 2014 because there's so much to talk about there. We haven't even gotten to the two congressional seats or the governor's race yet. But Kevin Landrigan, to you very quickly, what about Jonathan's complaint? You know, can't we find more homegrown people?
Well, certainly both. I mean, both Bob Smith and Jim Rubens in their own way are homegrown New Hampshire people. Neither was born in New Hampshire. Both came to the state kind of in young adulthood, if you will. Bob Smith left the state after losing the seat, moved to Florida for 10 years. That's the biggest obstacle he frankly has in trying to get traction in this primary.
Trying to reconnect with people
right,
after a decade
away.
Right,
as I said, Jim Rubens hasn't been on the ballot, but he's been very active, as you pointed out, Laura, in the fight to battle a casino in New Hampshire. So there's certainly more New Hampshire and more Granite State status than Scott Brown has. But I think it really goes, Jonathan's point really goes to the fact of how well Brown got into this race. As we can all recall, it was a lengthy courtship, and everybody waited for him to make a decision, which he didn't make officially until March, even though he had moved to Rye, New Hampshire in November. So he freezed out a lot of establishment Republicans who might have been thinking of taking on Scott Brown because they didn't know whether he was going to run or not.
Okay, and speaking of this issue, it's also come up in the New Hampshire race for governor. We'll find out more in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, escalating violence in the Gaza Strip, what the U.S. can and cannot do to ease the crisis, then best-selling author Chris Bohjalian on his new novel, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners, and support also comes to us from the law offices of Catherine J. Morneau, focusing on collaborative law practice, an alternative to the traditional practice of adversarial family litigation. More at morneaulaw.com. In the city of Claremont, information about Claremont's economic development initiatives and business relocation at claremontnh.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're checking in on how the political season is heating up in the Granite State with the primary 2 months from today, September 9th, and then the general election in early November. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments about some of the campaigning that you've seen already. If you want to know more about some of these candidates we're talking about, too, we'll take your comments, questions, thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. all one word. And gentlemen, just before the break, Jonathan, our caller, was saying, why don't we have more homegrown talent here in the Granite State? And Josh Rogers, to you, this came up in the governor's race as well with Walt Havenstein.
Well, you know, under the state constitution, a candidate for governor is supposed to have been an inhabitant of the state 7 years prior to running. Walt Havenstein spent most of, you know, a number of those 7 years living in Maryland, the majority of his time working down there, maintained his house in Alton. The ballot law commission, you know, took this up and voted 3-2 to say, you know, he fulfilled the requirement, because essentially there was always his clear intent. He had never surrendered his domicile, and his clear intent was to return.
And he voted in New Hampshire.
And he voted in New Hampshire. But there were, you know, documents, including a tax return in Maryland and, you know, a mortgage that he signed that suggested that, you know, his primary residence was in Maryland. In any case, it's been resolved. The ballot law commission voted 3-2. One Democratic member, Marty Vanute, a lawyer in Concord, going with the two Republicans, saying that he was fulfilled the residency requirement. So that's settled. He's running. He's facing Andrew Hemingway of Bristol, somebody who does come out of the Tea Party movement in that primary. And that primary is a pretty clear example of sort of establishment Havenstein, recruited by people in state and out state, backed by the National Republican Governors Association, versus Andrew Hemingway, who, you know, grassroots activist, you know, in his early 30s, active in the Tea Party movement, and ran Newt Gingrich's presidential campaign here last time around. So that's a very clear dynamic. And, you know, that's up for grabs, that race, frankly.
You think? Yeah, it's interesting. Well, as you mentioned, the Ballot Law Commission did certify at the end of the month in June that Havenstein was fine to run in New Hampshire. Let's just hear what Mr. Havenstein said about that.
The area that I think is most compelling is the fact that I came home. I came home routinely as often as I could, and so the context of domicile was never at issue, certainly not in my mind.
So, Dante Scala, that primary is settled, and as Josh said, it's going to be Havenstein versus Hemingway. What do you think about Josh's comment that, you know, this could go either way, this primary?
Well, again, you go back to the UNH poll, and you look at Walt Havenstein. About one out of seven Republicans knows who Havenstein is, at least enough to say something very rudimentary, as in, I have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of him. And about 8% of Republicans know who Hemingway is. So my point, the gap isn't that big. Now, it is true that Havenstein has ads up on television, and that's certainly going to help, I think, unless Hemingway can follow suit, to drive up Havenstein's name ID. But it is an important point that Havenstein is basically an unknown commodity. You really have to follow politics very, very closely to know who this man is. And again, we're 2 months away from the September primary.
All right. Well, I also want to talk to all of you about the races in the 1st and 2nd Congressional District. But let's go back to our listeners. And Deborah is in Exeter. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
On the issue of politics and many other factors, I guess, in the business world, it's like follow the money to find out what the original motivation is. And so I wonder if your guests have an opinion about who is financially backing whom and what their position is. I think with a little bit more transparency of who financially backs some of these candidates, in addition to the candidates' opinions on the issues, there might be a better ability for me as a voter to make a choice.
Deborah, thank you so much for calling. And Kevin Landergan, this is definitely worth looking into. Who are some of the big money forces that are already playing a role and who might play a role in the future?
Well, certainly in the U.S. Senate race, we already have independent groups spending millions of dollars either for Senator Jean Shaheen or against her. Americans for Prosperity has spent more than $2 million in ads against Shaheen, largely on Obamacare. Crossroads, a group tied to Karl Rove, the former kind of guru for ex-President George W. Bush, they've spent about $650,000 on ads against Shaheen. On Shaheen's side, she's had the Senate Majority PAC, which essentially is Harry Reid's war chest. They've spent about $650,000 supporting Shaheen. And the League of Conservation Voters, I alluded to earlier, a kind of left-of-center environmental group, they've spent over $400,000 and have some new ads on television this week, all attacking Scott Brown as a friend of the oil companies.
Let me just ask you a quick question, then Dante, I want you to jump in too. But Kevin, you mentioned AFP and Crossroads running anti-Gene Shaheen ads. Do those ads also say, and by the way, we like Scott Brown, or we like Bob Smith, or we like Jim Rubins?
No, they don't. I mean, and that's the very definition of independent expenditures. They take a singular position either for someone or against someone. And then in the parlance of TV advertising, independent expenditures in general, about 80% of them are attacking either the incumbent or a challenger.
Yeah, Dante, the role of money. It's a good question, Deborah. Thank you.
Yeah, a key thing that's missing in New Hampshire's primary so far that we've seen in other Republican primaries around the country is that this outside money is usually directed against the opposite party. It's not being spent on candidates within a party. So, for instance, you look at the Mississippi U.S. Senate primary. Outside groups come in on the establishment Republican side and on the Tea Party candidate side, and they fire away at each other. Here in New Hampshire, at least so far with 2 months to go, we've seen very little of that. I mean, Kevin mentioned Jim Rubin's super PAC. Well, what do? They post a website, which is all well and good. But if they're not going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars against Scott Brown on radio, on television, or even tens of thousands on mail, then they're not going to have much of an effect. So what we're waiting to see is whether groups Club for Growth, for example, which just endorsed Marilinda Garcia in the 2nd District, mm-hmm. whether they're going to come in and spend a lot of money on behalf of a Republican primary candidate against fellow Republicans.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. Well, and speaking of the 2nd Congressional District, here's an email from Christopher who says, even though a couple of the 2nd District Republican candidates fill the, quote, diversity void, which Republicans are always accused of having, Christopher says, Congresswoman Custer seems to connect better with the white Yankee slash hippie slash liberal vibe of that district, particularly the western part. Josh, do you want to describe the district a little bit? And is Christopher spot on with that description?
Well, he's certainly correct that the 2nd Congressional District is, which is the sort of essentially the western half of the state from the top, a little bit more liberal than the 1st Congressional
District.
Includes
Hanover, Keene, Concord, cities like that.
Yes. And it's true that Anne McLean Custer is somebody who does well with the base of her party. She's been active in Democratic politics for a long time. She's been active on behalf of abortion rights issues for some time, which is, a big issue within the Democratic Party. And, she does, she's Yankee and she's white. I'm not sure I'd say she's a hippie, but she does reasonably well with that demographic.
Yeah. And how about in the 1st District? That's a different animal, isn't it, Dante?
It is. I mean, the 2nd Congressional District definitely leans 2 or 3 points Democratic. But now the 1st District actually leans slightly Republican. I mean, it is the quintessential swing district, battleground district, and it's an endangered species, the battleground district, in American politics. I mean, you can count them, the number of congressional races that are actually competitive. They're in the few dozens. So both of these races, actually, the 1st and the 2nd District, are going to see a lot of money coming in because there are so few House races. But in that 1st District, Carol Shea Porter, Democratic congresswoman, always lives on the edge, always lives on the margins in that district because of its composition. So she won it in 06 in a big Democratic year, kept it in 08, lost it in a big Republican year in 10, came back in 12, 14. Who knows? But it doesn't look like it's going to be. No, I've never heard anyone say it's going to be a big Democratic year. It ranges between mediocre and poor.
Wow. Okay. So that's it. That matters especially for Carol Shea Porter, you're saying, Dante.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say, too, and all you need to do is look at the polling data over the past year. I mean, the poll that just came out had Ginta up by 3 points. But in April, Carol Shea Porter was up by 9. Back in January, Ginta was up by 6. This race has flip-flopped already a couple of times. In the latest poll, it's clear that Ginta has firmed up support, particularly among independent voters, than he had before, but I think it's going to be close right to the very end if Ginta manages to get by Dan Innes, who this poll showed this week, as Josh alluded to, really narrowed the gap between Carol Shea Porter by almost 10 points. He's not well known here, but it's clear Republicans and conservative independents have strengthened their opposition to Carol Shea Porter. So if Dan Innes can make a compelling reason why the establishment candidate Ginther should not be the nominee, he's got a real shot.
Let's take one more call from a listener. John's in Hanover. Hi, John. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Morning. I know this is rather beyond the scope of what you're talking about, but you were talking about the Tea Party earlier.
Sure.
And one of the most interesting sets of primaries, I think, where the Tea Party does turn up is in the state Senate and state House representatives, where Tea Party people are challenging more establishment Republican senators.
You know, this is a good question, and you're right, John. We were going to focus on some of the big races this hour, but I did want to ask you guys, so thanks for the call, John. I did want to ask you guys, Josh, to you first, what impact these big national races, Congress, governor, and so forth, will have down ticket at the State House for the legislature, for executive council?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know. Obviously, like a big wave, and you know, while right now it's, you know, hard to know if we're going to see a wave election, and which is, you know, often what we say. But every year in New Hampshire since 2004 has amounted to, you know, a wave for somebody. I mean, Dante's probably right that no one's out there saying this is going to be a banner year for Democrats, except for real, you know, party activists at this point in time. But, you know, the caller is right that there are some interesting Republican primaries in the wake of some of the votes on the gas tax, on expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare. There are conservatives challenging some incumbents. You know, David Booten in District 16 is facing a you know, Tea Party-ish challenger. Nancy Stiles is facing a challenge from the right. The vacant seat by Bob Odell's retirement sets up an interesting dynamic between, you know, J.P. Marzullo, who's pretty conservative, and Jerry Little, who used to run the New Hampshire Bankers Association, is more establishment Republican type. And so those primaries, and there may be, I don't know, it's possible there might be another one or two that I'm missing. The primary down in District 19, Jim Rausch's retirement, is interesting. You've got sort of a reasonable spectrum of Republicans running there. And, you know, there's one quite interesting Democratic primary. The retirement of Sylvia Larson has prompted a primary between Cass Ardinger, who's the head of the Concord School Board and, you know, was sort of handpicked by Sylvia Larson to be her successor, versus Dan Feltes, who's done a pretty good job and certainly has, you know, has campaign signs up already in profusion in my neighborhood, who's a legal aid lawyer running. And so the primaries will be interesting in the state Senate.
Yeah. So thanks for the call, John, because it is an interesting point, Dante Scala. And Josh is right. There were a lot of retirements in the Senate. There's always a lot of turnover in the House. So do you think we will be seeing more of this Tea Party versus establishment dynamic in these lower ticket races?
Yeah, for sure, especially in the primaries. I mean, the Tea Party in New Hampshire has had the most success in the state legislative races because the barrier to entry is so low. I mean, for a lot of, you know, for the parties, it's really a matter of, you know, recruiting candidates to run for these 400 seats. So if you want to have an impact, then the maximum impact can take place, you know, just by recruiting very conservative candidates, as was done in 2010 by Bill O'Brien, for example, and getting them on the ballot. And once they're on the ballot for the general election, well, then, you know, voters are saying, is there an R next to their name or a D next to their name? They don't necessarily know, is this a right-center Republican or is this a Tea Party Republican?
Yeah. Kevin, relating to what our caller says, the WMUR Granite poll that we've been talking about predicted Republicans would take back the New Hampshire House and hold on to the Senate. Now, again, it's very early. We're still 2 months out from the primary. But what did you make of that?
It didn't surprise me, frankly. A 15-9 split in the Senate seems pretty strong. That's almost a wave number. But I think the poll really reflects, as Andy will point out, these numbers are so early and so speculative that the chances of them being 100% accurate are 0%. But it's really a reflection of enthusiasm among the parties right now. If you do Democrat-Republican for a state legislature, it's 50-50. It's like 35-35. But if you ask voters, are you enthusiastic about this election? Are you definitely going to vote? 70% of Republicans say yes. Only 50% of Democrats say yes. That's why when you add that into the matrix, Republicans will have larger turnout in November, and therefore there'll be this kind of mini wave, which is really what it would be in the House. It would be a swap of about 40 seats, which frankly isn't a watershed.
No, it's not a lot, is it?
A watershed election. And in the state Senate, it'd be a net gain of two Senate seats, which, again, is not what we saw in 2010 when Republicans gained 3-1 majorities in the House and the Senate.
Well, and one thing that's also going to be interesting to look at is turnout in general. Certainly the expectation is that there would be lower turnout this time than in a presidential year, and therefore redistricting maps passed under Republican leadership might have a greater effect than they did in the last election when turnout was big in a presidential year. That's something that certainly Republican leaders believe to be the case.
Yeah. So, Dante, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. And it all really starts from the top. I mean, Mitt Romney mentioned Barack Obama is not on the ticket, but Obama certainly has a lot of influence, and it goes from the top down. I mean, Obama nationally is at about 44% approval. If that number goes down towards, say, George W. Bush second term territory, as it was 8 years ago, then we could have another 2010. On the other hand, maybe the economy keeps getting better, Obama stabilizes and moves back up, and maybe that turnout differential reduces in time for November for the Democrats.
Well, it's kind of like how we started our conversation. Primaries are a lot about turnout. If I don't want to say all about turnout, but a lot. Kevin, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and down ballot support for parties is all about the race for governor, and it always has been. That's one of the reasons why establishment Republicans are concerned about Walt Havenstein in this primary. They want a strong Republican nominee. In 2010, John Stephen got 46% of the vote against a popular John Lynch. That's why Republicans down ballot were able to get 3-1 majorities. Kelly Ayotte above John Stephen did even much better, but John Stephen held the base. He got 45, and that's really the number. Havenstein or Hemingway need to get at least 45% for Republicans to make significant gains down ballot.
Okay. Thank you all very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Josh Rogers, Kevin Landrigan, Dante Scala joining us for a conversation about this fall's elections. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Puglia. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on a housing mismatch in the Granite State. A recent report finds that with shifting New Hampshire demographics, household incomes, and lifestyles, our housing stock soon won't fit us anymore. And it predicts this infrastructure disconnect could be a drag on future economic growth. We'll find out more and what the authors say might create a more balanced housing market. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Wolfboro Pediatrics at Huggins Hospital, caring for children from newborn to age 21, reminding parents to schedule back-to-school physicals online at hugginshospital.org. And Prescott Park Arts Festival with C&J Bus Lines presenting Shrek the Musical this summer in Portsmouth, Thursdays to Sundays through August 24th. Open to the public at prescottpark.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The Israeli military has fired at Hamas militants in more than 400 sites in Gaza. Palestinians say at least 32 people have been killed. In the past few days, Hamas has launched more than 150 rockets into Israel, some deflected.